Welcome to the Tell Us Something podcast. I'm Mark Moss, your host. Tell Us Something, inspired by the moth, seeks to celebrate the craft of live storytelling. The Missoula community comes together for a night of shared stories told live, focused on a theme. Tell Us Something is a quarterly event. Everyone has a story. What's yours? This week we are pleased to present to you the Tell Us Something event with the theme Dear Diary as recorded in its entirety on December 15th, 2011 at the Missoula Art Museum. Our storytellers are Susan Maruka, Nate Beal, Trisha Opstad, Kyle McAfee, Caroline Keyes, and Jeremy Smith. Thank you for listening. And now, the stories. What a great turnout. Thanks for coming. So I'm not telling a story, so I can cheat. I've got notes. So, as she said, the name is changing. We have been known as the Missoula Moth. And the moth from New York City got a hold of us and said, hey, that's a little bit of infringement. Can you please change your name? And we love the moth, and so we want to grant their wish. And so from now on, we're known as Tell Us Something. So welcome to the very first Tell Us Something storytelling event. Tell Us Something. Tell Us Something seeks to celebrate the art and craft of storytelling in a community setting, so we welcome all of the community to participate as audience members and as storytellers. So if you would like to tell a story at the next event, which is March 6th at the Top Hat, you can, for now, as we make the transition, submit your request to contribute at missoulamoth@gmail.com, which will soon change. And I'll be putting that information out on Facebook and Twitter and the missoulamoth.com site as that transitions. So, as Anna asked, no leaning against the walls. We've got plenty of seats down here. No drinks in the gallery space. You can leave your drinks outside. Thank you. And if you want a piece of Missoula history, we have these awesome screen-printed, one-of-a-kind posters designed by Josh Quick, printed by the fine folks at GarageTees.com. They're signed and numbered. There are only about probably 70 left, never to be printed again. So they're for free in the back if you want to take one with you when you go. Please turn off your cell phones. We want to give all of our speakers your full attention. Tell Us Something. Stories last 10 minutes. They are true. They're told without notes. And they're told on a theme. Tonight's theme, to coincide with the storytelling that was going on in the other room, is Dear Diary. Our first speaker, Susan Maruka. My friend Susan and I met shortly after she moved to Missoula. It was her birthday. I had an art show. She and her friends were at my art show, and they bought her a piece of art. I've since come to know Susan's wit and laughter and gourmet cooking. She's a software developer here in town, a potter, and a brilliant woman. And her favorite gum is always green. Susan Maruka.
And I have to say that I'm really jealous of everybody that I see chewing gum right now. I've been on a mission to find some gum. My mouth is a little dry. Thank you all for being here. I better start telling my story or else Mark is going to ring the gong soon. I walked into a hot, windowless room, and I had no idea that within the hour, half a dozen mullet-sporting, mustached, middle-aged men in polyester dress slacks were going to lay their hands on me. It was the 80s. I was 15, And I was a guest of my good friend Lisa at the Teeter Creek Pentecostal Church of God in Barber County, West Virginia. I had been invited by my friend Lisa to attend church with her, and I acquiesced on that Sunday because, well, first, Lisa was a redheaded, popular, cute cheerleader, and I was the captain of the recreational mathematics team. Our friendship was improbable. It deserved to be honored. Second, I was generally rebelling against my atheist scientist parents by honoring the Sabbath. Third, I wanted more than anything to experience for myself the great mystery of existence. You know, the intertwining oneness of everything. And I thought at the time that God, or religion at least, would help me accomplish this. As the service started, I was filled with apprehension and nausea that usually accompanies naked anxiety nightmares. I was pretty sure I was clothed, but I knew that I was really out of place. But I was dying to see how the story would unfold. This church convened in a repurposed gas station many miles outside of town. There was a congregation of about 30 people, and they started randomly praying out loud, mostly in English, shouting out hymns and thank you, Jesus. And the pastor was making some statements that sounded kind of compelling, if not totally confusing. And the whole time there was this woman standing at the front on a platform, and she was an old lady in rather shabby clothes. And my friend Lisa told me that she sometimes delivered prophecies, and she always stood ready. About the time that I thought I had succeeded in stealthily going unnoticed, the pastor called out for souls to be saved. And Lisa's pom-pom clasping grip on my arm caused me to be standing in the middle of the room, suddenly surrounded by the polyester mullet men and the prophet lady. And my friend Lisa, whose friendship suddenly seemed way less probable. My escape was blocked. My armpits were sweating, somewhat like they are now. And as the hands came down on me and my impending salvation loomed, my lower self secretly wished that I had voided my bladder in the bushes outside before the service started. The faces around me contorted with glory and expectation. Eyes were fluttering backwards, and there were calls to the Spirit to enter me and relieve me of my burden of sin, and chance for me to be set free. And oh my gosh, I wanted to be set free. And this pulsating swell of prayer became louder and louder and louder until, yes, praise Jesus, the hands all lifted up, and I felt nothing. I felt nothing but a big confusion as cold and vast as the universe. And I realized, oh my gosh, I am riding the spiritual short bus. How could this be? How could it happen that all these people thought, did we have the same experience here? They all thought that I was saved, and I came away knowing that I wasn't. Did they fake it? I don't think they faked it. I think they were fools. And it turns out I was spiritually incompetent. At that moment, I decided I really needed to pursue other avenues of rebellion against my parents, like drugs or sex or something more conventional. At that point, I abandoned religion. And I decided to seek my truth from the one thing I knew I could trust, science. I spent 20 years pursuing truth from science. I studied physics, chemistry, biology, mathematics, statistics, astronomy. I asked so many questions. I honed questions like they were the edge of a knife. I sought arenas that rewarded and nurtured driven questioners, because that's what I was, a driven questioner. My questions gave birth to new questions, and I had a passel of grandchildren questions, all of which I tended. And I realized that learning how to question and how to give birth to questions taught me to disbelieve. My strategy was that I would accept any idea as plausible, but disbelieve every one that wasn't nailed to the wall with the hammer of my own empiricism. At that point, I would have denied gravity if I didn't have a whole lot of, you know, incontrovertible proof for its existence. Every waking moment became an opportunity for data collection. Every event that I witnessed, I could ascribe to random chance or a grand pattern. And if I managed to keep OCD at bay, it's fun. So years of science, though satisfying and fun, didn't make me feel or help me to understand the deep interconnectedness that I still believed was possible. So science, my chosen path, actually pulled me further from my great mystery. So to summarize, religion, total bust. Science, not quite. So how am I going to find this one elusive thing that I really need? A few years ago, I met Linda. Linda is an old hippie. She has a raspy voice and a hearty laugh and frizzy hair that's parted down the middle. And she's the mother of a friend. She lived with me in my house for a time while she was going through transition. Linda was about as real and good as a person can be. So real and good that you realize other people are not as real or good. She had no interest in religion, nor in science. We became great friends. She told me soon after she moved in with me that she was an energy healer. She would help people overcome their emotional pain by reading their auras or communicating with the spirits, or transferring universal healing energy to wherever it needed to be. And we sat on my porch many, many hours in the warmth of summertime, watching the changing light and the dogwoods blooming and the bumblebees buzzing. And she told me story after story of helping people overcome their pain and opening channels to truth and healing with her hands and removing psychic obstacles. And I thought, oh my gosh, she really believes that she has these powers. And of course, you might imagine, I believed that she did not. And this was troubling because she was my friend and I didn't want her to be a quack. But I wondered if the people she thought she healed were at all like myself 20 years before, standing in the middle of an old gas station in the heart of Appalachia, expecting salvation and receiving instead nothing but years of hollow skepticism. But as long as she merely told me stories and didn't ask me to participate, I could shelter her from my disbelief. And I convinced myself that it didn't really matter what I thought. So, of course, she's a massage therapist. One day she invited me to have a massage. And, of course, I never turned down a free massage, so I said yes. And I'm on her massage table. She'd been working on me for about an hour, and I was trying to relax. She said, "You know, Susan, I think I feel something here. You have a sort of energetic blockage. And if you're comfortable, I could open a channel and explore this a little more. So if you're game, you know, it might really help." And I thought, oh, no, this is not good. Because, Linda, I don't want to expose you as a fraud. But necessity is the mother of invention, and curiosity is its crazy drunk uncle. And I needed a reinvention of my belief system or disbelief system. And I was really curious. Maybe my disbeliefs could suspend themselves. Maybe I could get a little taste of the great mystery. And if this doesn't work, I will never ask again. So I said to Linda, So is this this opening the channel thing, will this work if I don't really do my part properly? And she looked at me, and I knew that she knew that I was a disbeliever. And she kind of smiled and said, yeah, it'll work. And I was like, all right, knock yourself out, unblock me. And I closed my eyes, and she moved her hands over me. And it was as though I had, up to that moment, been in a very small room, leaning against the door to my own soul. And it flew open. And where I expected ground and sky and familiar objects, there was nothing but a wide openness through which I tumbled and tumbled and tumbled. And I had no sense of my body. I had no sense of my mind. I had no sense of my senses. And I just kept tumbling. And it was indescribable and utterly freeing and utterly frightening and utterly, utterly real. And I was jerked back then to the present moment by Linda grabbing my wrists and kind of shaking me and saying, whoa. I thought maybe I lost you there for a minute. Apparently, I had been convulsing for a couple of minutes on her table. And as I unclenched my fists and caught my breath, Linda leaned in and whispered to me, you know, Susan, it's okay to believe in it. And it was, and it is. Thank you.
Susan Maruca. Our next speaker is Nate Beal. Nate takes risks. As a person and as an artist, he's a brilliant musician who's in a few bands that maybe you've heard of. Cash for Junkers, Tullis, Saltbrush String Band, and Broken Valley Roadshow. He even played at my wedding. He loves playing with digital media, and he sometimes writes about his artistic adventures at makelovenotsuccess.com. Please welcome Nate Beal.
So when I read this story to myself the first time today, it was 18 minutes. So we'll see how we go. Oh, the time's running. So when I was a senior in high school, my mom was going through my car, and she found my diary. And it wasn't really a diary. It was a day planner that I had repurposed as a diary. And when you think about the difference between the two, it's kind of interesting. A day planner is something that a responsible senior in high school would put things about the future in, things about like college application deadlines, SAT, stuff I knew nothing about. And I had totally perverted the thing and instead put the stuff from the past that I was doing instead of getting my shit together in it. And so then it was a diary. And as a parent now, I know that there were things in there that were probably really hard for her to read. Things like, you know, memorable moments from Keggers that past summer. Embarrassingly accurate chronological descriptions of encounters with my current girlfriend. And probably what was hardest to read was an hour-to-hour description of an incident that had happened earlier that year that had resulted in a lot of time in a courtroom for me. But more importantly, the loss of a young man's life. I had a group of friends. We were, as Mark said, we were risk takers. It's been a thing for a while. And we generally pushed our luck. We weren't like thugs or badasses or anything, but we were thrill seekers. You know, we kind of pushed our luck for that. And a couple of friends and I were on our way to Great Falls, Montana to push our luck. We had one thing in mind. We were going to get fucked up. We were going to meet new girls. We were going to push our luck in general, you know? And the first night, it was like a three-day thing. The first night there was a complete disaster. It was a total flop. There were no chicks. There was no booze. We ended up in sleeping bags on somebody's floor, like sleepover style, watching The Exorcist and Faces of Death. And it was just totally, Okay, and so the next morning comes around, and the next morning is really hazy for me. And human memory is kind of this fragile and fickle thing. And the way I understand it is there's three ways that it can go awry. It can go awry physically, like when you're encoding the memory, when you're writing it to your brain. It can go awry in the storage mechanism, like if you hit your head, somehow it's stored, or in the retrieval. Now, I'm getting a little older. You might say that it's hazy because of the storage thing, but I think it's the encoding thing, because the first thing we did that morning was mix a bottle of Everclear with a can of frozen grape juice and split that amongst a handful of high schoolers. And so the next few hours are kind of like a movie montage in my head. There's loud music. There's girls. The girls are pretty. All the things about the night before are remedied. You know, there's booze and there's women, and I'm scared of the women. And so I drink more, and I don't really want to take my shirt off at the beach. So I drink more, and I come to in this snap, and I'm sitting in the backseat of a car on the driveway next to another car, and one of the prettiest girls is like sliding her short shorts in the backseat next to me, and I'm recoiling in fear. I have no idea what to say. And she says, "I am not going anywhere with that drunk motherfucker. He is going to kill somebody." And she points to the car next to me. And this is the point where I really wish that my internal diary had some sort of, that I could just go back and read it, because there's really important information that's missing here. Because I can't tell you why I didn't get out of the car. I can't tell you why I didn't go and pull my friends out of the car next to me. But moments like that, moments to do the right thing, they go by kind of fast. And I'd miss my opportunity. And we're driving. And the sun is shining. We're back to this montage moment. And the music is loud. And there's a girl sitting next to me. And somebody passes somebody else. And then the gauntlet is thrown, and somebody passes somebody else again. And here's where that thrill-seeking and that risk-taking and that pushing-the-limits thing starts. And before too long, we're on the downslope of a hill side by side in a two-lane road, and nobody's giving an inch, and everybody's going at top speed, and nobody's going to let anybody else around. And we're really pushing our luck, and our luck broke at that point. And the cars come into contact with each other, and the car I'm in starts into this slow sort of 90-mile-an-hour sideways drift. And out the back window, I can watch that other truck, and I watch it disappear into this tornado of just dirt and debris, like something off TV. And I heard on the news later, I have no idea how they knew this, but I heard on the news later that week that that truck rolled 14 times. And the first thing I see when I get out of the truck is this kid walking towards me, and he's got identical slashes in his forearms, and there's this blood, there's blood coming out of, and it's black blood. And I grew up in rural Montana, and rural Montana's kind of a do-it-yourself biology lab. So we taught ourselves how mammals work with 22 long rifles and folding buck knives, and I had cut open hundreds of beings by this point in my life. And I knew that when I saw blood like that, blood that was that color, that we were in real trouble. And the next thing I see is my friend Ed, who was in the back of the truck next to us. And he is just planted in the dirt. He's covered in dirt. I can't even see the color of his clothes. It's just dirt. He looks like a mummy. And before I could think about what was happening, he sits up, and I can see clumps of dirt coming off of his eyelids and this big black hole where his mouth should be, and he's sucking air, but he was alive, so I moved on. And the next thing I see is the truck that was coming next to us. And the truck has come to rest upright after it rolled all those times, and the driver's missing, and it's just chaos. People are looking for the driver, and I somehow get convinced that the driver is underneath the truck. And I remember being on my belly and scraping at it like a dog after a varmint some way. And there's a girl in the truck, and she can't get herself out because the door has been mashed on because it was, you know, it was rolled. And you hear these things about feats of strength and adrenaline. And this has only happened this one time to me in my life, but I folded the window frame down with one hand and then stuck my foot on and ripped that door. I just remember a big crunch and pulling the girl out and then trying to tip over this truck by myself to try and find a person underneath. And I don't know who found him. For years, I've been telling myself that I found him. And when I started trying to get in touch with the story to tell it to you people, I can't piece that together. My diary doesn't have that. So I don't know who found him. But the driver of the truck was laying on his back in the tall weeds, and it seemed like he was hundreds of feet away on the far side of the wreckage. Not like he'd been deposited there on the way, like my friend Ed had, who my friend Ed lived, by the way, but like he'd been thrown beyond where the truck came to rest a long ways. And he was laying on his back, and his skull was not shaped right. And there was blood coming out of his nose. And the diary in my mind is never, ever, ever going to forget what it sounded like when he was fighting to breathe, ever. And I remember a couple hours later in the hospital, somebody saying that after he came out of surgery, they were going to put him on life support. And I knew that second that he was never going to wake up, that that was a complete waste of time, that he was never going to wake up because his eyes were half open when we found him and there was just no life in him. All that breathing was involuntary. And he didn't wake up. And so to make a long story shorter, because this is a long story, the next real clear memory in my mental diary is being next to my friend Ed's hospital bed. And his internal diary is completely malfunctioning. He would wake up and he'd shake his head and he'd open his eyes and he'd look at me and he'd say, "Nate Beal, where are we?" And I would say, "Hey, we're in a hospital. I had to tell him what town we were in. We weren't at home, you know. We're in Great Falls. We got in a car crash. Somebody might die." And he would react to this in the way that anybody would in waking up to this news. It was complete shock, you know. He would, and he'd close his eyes. And then 90 seconds later, it would happen again. His internal diary was not working. He'd shake his head and he'd look at me and he'd say, "Where are we?" And I did this with him for the rest of the day. Relived that day in 2-minute snippets for the rest of the day until finally the hospital staff told me that I'm not family and I had to go. And I realized at that moment that I didn't have anywhere to go. I was the only member of the party who came to town who wasn't in police custody or hospitalized. I didn't have a car. I didn't even have any shoes. And I was 18. By that time, I was 18 years old. The police never called my parents. The hospital didn't have to call my parents. And I'll tell you what, I sure as hell wasn't calling my parents at that point to tell them what was going on. And so I actually didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell them when I finally made it. There's a whole lot of events that happened. But when I finally made it home 24 hours later, I peeled off the hospital slippers that I've been wearing for the last day and a half and threw them in the garbage, walked into my house barefoot, and I got some shoes, and I left. And my parents, I eventually did get the guts to tell them what happened. I think they found out some other way and asked me about it. And then they found out a lot more details about that whole situation from courtroom testimony and police depositions and stuff like that. But I don't think they knew the extent of what happened until my mom found that diary in my car and read it. It was a day planner, though. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Nate. I forgot who the next person is now. Trisha Opstad. Trisha tells stories conceptually through theater, dance, and poetry. She's not tied to a strict narrative form. Last May, she performed a one-woman show entitled The Human Flight Experiment as part of the May Artini event here at the Missoula Art Museum. She welcomes opportunities to perform because they motivate and stimulate her creative force within and soften her hard edges. This storytelling event provides a space for Trisha to honor great storytellers that came before her and to engage with the community in a human experience we all know so well. Please welcome Trisha Opstad.
Winter is upon us. We are in the heart of
winter. It's dark, really dark. It's cold. And the holiday season is in full force. Consumerism, hype, it's about to drive me crazy. I feel a little crazy sometimes. When I am about to break, I look up across the sky. When I see birds flying together in a flock, it gives me solace. I also enjoy watching them just sort of hop from branch to branch with each other. It gives me some sense of simplicity. And I truly long to be a bird when I watch them. Almost like I was a bird at one time in my life. Could that be? I moaned and I cried to say, hey, let me come back. Let me come back to the flock. I know, it sounds crazy, right? Maybe it's just the winter. My parents, they both grew up on farms in North Dakota. And in North Dakota, the winters are harsh, bitter, and cold. And they last well into June sometimes. On my father's side, my grandmother Clara had a sister named Elvie, and she received shock treatment to manage her depression. On my father's side, on my mother's side, my great-grandfather Fred Miller, he was from a large family. And he became the family's scapegoat. His father took out a lot of his anger on my great-grandfather, Fred Miller. Anyway, he met my great-grandmother, Berthy, and they had my grandmother, Betty, and he was about 20 years old. Berthy refused to tell stories about my great-grandfather, so this is the only story that I have about Fred Miller. He lost control, and in an impulse, he took his team of horses and raced through town, endangering people's lives. And this must have been the last straw in a long line of incidents. He was arrested, and after that, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. He was put in a mental institution in Jamestown, North Dakota for the rest of his life. My grandmother never knew her father. My grandmother, Betty, she married Bernard, and he was a very hardworking man, but very careful as well. He would check the locks on the doors before he would go to bed every night, several times. He'd check the stove to make sure it was off before he left the house. He would check his oil and meticulously look at the engine and make sure everything was in proper order before he went out on an outing. I remember he would go into the bathroom several times during the day to wash his hands over and over and over and over. Scrubbing the nails, making sure everything was clean. I went into the bathroom and I looked at the green sink, seeing the soap suds from his hand washing. When I was growing up, from a very young age, from the age of 3, I was dancing. I was tumbling in the backyard. I remember specifically in the kitchen, standing at the black metal railing on the stairs, practicing my ballet steps, doing a plié, relevé, and I thought it was so cool because I was speaking French, and I had this overpour of emotions as a child, and it was this really wonderful, luxurious way to express it. My family got used to it. They got comfortable having this dancing girl in the kitchen. It was like a natural fixture in the environment. Dancing somehow helped me cope. And I never really figured that out till later. I never really figured out the potency of that art of dancing until later. So Bernard, the man that washed his hands over and over and over, had a daughter, my mother. And my mother, she walked pigeon-toed when she was a child. So Bernard was very concerned about this and needed to correct it. So she got special shoes and braces for her legs. My mother also told me that she stuttered. Only recently, when I got my speech therapy degree, she said that her mind rambled and was moving so fast that her mouth couldn't keep up with the words. My mom takes Wellbutrin in the winter months to manage her depression. Wellbutrin is a more mild form of medication than the other ones on the market. However, it does increase the likelihood of seizures. Wellbutrin increases the likelihood of seizures, It increases the likelihood of seizures. Wellbutrin increases the likelihood of seizures. I usually speak methodically, and it takes me a little while to formulate my thoughts before I know what to say. And my mom, when I was talking with her when I was younger, she would grow impatient, and she would finish my sentences for me. This was okay until later when I left the house, and I tried to speak in front of groups or even with people, and I didn't know how to finish my own sentences. I don't take medication, but I have been known to overeat, sleep a lot, and isolate, take long showers. My sister, she's 2 years older than me. She takes Zoloft for depression, and she takes Trazodone to help her sleep. Side effects of Zoloft include a lot, but a couple are insomnia and reduced sexual drive. Anyway, we were talking just recently, and I asked what she was reading. She said, "I'm reading An Unquiet Mind by Kay Redfield Jamison." It's about a woman who struggles with bipolar disorder. A little bit later in the conversation, I said, "So I just want to say, I understand that you didn't want me around when we were younger. I understand that when I was born, I probably took away most of the attention that was there. And in a beat, she said, anything I ever did to you wasn't because of you. It was because of me. It was because of my own unquiet mind. And I said, I forgive you.
Thank you, Tricia. Kyle McAfee. Kyle is a 28-year-old performer, writer, and visual artist. He's lived in Missoula for 20 years, enjoys Michael Douglas movies, and hip-hop music. Kyle won second place in the Poetry Slam at this year's Festival of the Book. Please welcome Kyle McAfee.
Yeah, was partially afraid slash wishing that I would trip on the way up here and somehow impale myself on the microphone and not have to do this. But I do like Michael Douglas movies. He used to be my spirit animal, so. In my life, I've had two black eyes. I know I kind of look like a fighter, so. But the first one was really dumb. I was like 16 or 17, and I had a remote control for the TV that I like to spin in my hand a lot. And one day it just hit me in the eye. So that was pretty cool to explain to people. But the second one was actually kind of cool. I was 18, and I had just been dumped by a woman that was 10 years my senior, which I thought was a pretty big coup. Not getting dumped, but having the relationship in the first place. And so I was pretty depressed from that. And I was coming off that depression and went to a party with my friend, and it was a winter solstice party, and he took us to the party with a bunch of his older sister's friends who, anyway, they all kind of knew that I had been in this relationship, and they were all friends with her and in her age group. And so that being said, one of his sister's friends was really hot. And I was like, I totally got this, but I didn't. She had a boyfriend. But anyway, she was really cool. We went up to the party, and we were all drinking, and I got to flirting with her, and which wasn't totally inappropriate. But it was pretty blatant flirting, and we were just talking, and she kind of playfully pushes me, and I'm like, yeah, playfully push her back, and she just punches me in the face. And it turns out she was a black belt in karate, and it was an instant reflex for her to punch me in the face for playfully shoving her. And so I managed to hold it together while she took me over to the snowbank and was putting snow on my eye, and all of a sudden I just start crying. Just bawling. And she was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I know you're going through a hard time. And I was like, can I kiss you? And so we totally ended up making out. And as I have a swollen eye and tears all over my face, huge turn on for women. Yeah, and her boyfriend was there, but I don't think he saw this going on unless they had some kind of implicit arrangement where she ended up punching so many boys in the face that he was like, yeah, you got to go make out with them to make up for it. but I don't think so. He didn't see it. But it was awesome. And I was totally instantly in love with her, which is sad and kind of psychologically fucked up, I think. So, yeah, and then went home the next day and had to explain I'd been hit in the face by a girl. And after a while, I kind of didn't want to explain the whole thing, so I just would say that I hit myself in the face with my remote control again. So that's it. I know it was pretty short, but thank you.
I guess that we're done with the mic stand. Caroline Keyes. Caroline plays banjo, guitar, and sings in Stellarondo, and plays in a variety of other Missoula bands, including but not limited to Broken Valley Roadshow, Wise River Mercantile, and the New Hijackers. Caroline also played at my wedding. Depending upon who you ask, Caroline either couldn't get an interview for a job that was worthy of her or has written off traditional day jobs in favor of being a full-time artist. She's played over 200 gigs this year with various groups, and her band Stellarondo is currently involved in collaboration with writer Rick Bass, scoring some of his short fiction. Please join me in welcoming Caroline Keyes.
So, at a birthday party when I was kind of a tween in Lynchburg, Virginia, I overheard two girls say to each other, or one of the girls say to another one of the girls, only if you like really don't know the person very well do you give stationery or a diary to them for their birthday. And I heard that, and I took it to heart, and kind of kept receiving diaries for my birthday, and they kept stacking up on the shelf, and I kind of refused to write anything down in them. And instead, maybe not instead, but maybe instead, I made mixtapes. And I, my dress is coming open, just ignore that. Oh, wow. It's okay, there's a slip under there. Anyway, I have about 25 years worth of mixtapes around my house. And there's now they are CDs and they go on iPods and stuff like that. But sometimes I like to take myself out to lunch. One of my favorite out to lunch spots used to be the Wild Plum over in Dixon. I love to take a drive and go out to lunch, and that's no longer there. But recently I decided to go to Sealy Lake for lunch. And I dipped my hand into a big Tupperware tub full of mixtapes. And I picked one out, and it was a mixtape that I made in response to my very first unsupervised road trip in 1992 with a dear friend who was about to go out on a gap year to England, and with a boy who was a good friend of mine, and who, not on the first night of that road trip and not on the last night of that road trip, but on the second to last night of that road trip, climbed up the ladder to the loft where I was sleeping in his family's pool house and kissed me. And at that point, that was the second kiss that I'd ever had in my life. And the first one also came from him and had been at the very end of the previous school year before we all went our separate ways for the summer. This was a boarding school, so we all came together for the school year and went away for the summer. And so I had some pretty big hopes that this would happen again. And so once we returned back to town, our road trip took us from Lynchburg to Williamsburg, Virginia, to Hampton, Virginia, and then down to Danville, Virginia, where his family, he lived on a plantation that had been in his family for years. His family had exported tobacco to Europe. And so here we are in Montana. It's 20 years later, and I'm putting this mixtape in for the drive to Seeley Lake. And the first song comes on. Deeper shade of soul, yeah. And I'm like, wow, this is going to be a really fun trip. So I'm driving by myself, singing. I mean, I knew all the words, singing along. And I can't wait to see what the next song is going to be. And the next song is by Body Count. I forgot to say that I'd been dreaming about this boy all summer. And every time any, like, Indigo Girls or James Taylor, anything came on, you know, I was always like, oh, I think the song's about him. And so when this Body Count song came on, like, I was thinking about, wow, Caroline, like, excellent, bold choice there, putting this explicit lyric stuff on this mixtape at age 16. And I got to listening to the song, and I realized that it was nothing way out there, nothing really that rebellious. It was kind of a Brer Rabbit tale about bedding the daughter of the Grand Wizard of the KKK. Like, I was like, Ice-T, you know, go on. That's not as edgy as maybe I thought it was back in the day. And so I keep driving. I'm past Lubrecht. I took a left at the Cow. I'm heading north, and Perry Farrell comes on. Oh, baby. I'm so tired. And I'm like, but I'm not tired. I could drive to Bab, and then I could drive to the North Pole, because this is the best mixtape ever. And here I am in 1992, like, so hopeful that taking some of the gems from this road trip that I'd just been on and putting them onto a tape and then giving them to the guy is just going to make everything better. I keep driving, and I get to a song, and I actually end up, I passed Seeley Lake, which was my final destination, because the tape was still going, and the song was just going, do-do-do, do-do-do-do-do, and I could have driven all day, but I turned around, and I stopped at the filling station, and ordered some lunch, and I sat down, and I was just filled with compassion and empathy for the me 20 years ago who had made this tape, like, in a way that I never would have felt about myself in the moment then, and don't now. I don't treat myself like that now, but I was just thinking, God, there's just so much. I mean, that was bold in my own little sense, to get these songs together and to put them on there. And I know that I gave him a copy, because I always keep a copy for myself. And I just was feeling great, and ate my JoJo's, and kind of came back to Missoula. And it's just funny to think about the spools in a tape. Like, it's not really an infinity sign. There's an end, and then it spirals back around. And got back in the car to go home, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers kept coming on, and I'm like, ugh, like, really? Like, I'm not. Maybe it's just because of where they are now and where I am now, but that wasn't doing it for me. And then there was some Primus, to be sure, and I got, I was gradually kind of losing energy, and pulled into where you have to go 30 miles an hour at Bonner, and that Megadeth song came on, just like the Pied Piper led rats through the street. And I'm like, what? like, you don't really like this stuff, Caroline. Like, this was not what you were listening to at this time. And then finally, as I was pulling off the interstate, coming back into the Rattlesnake to go home, the song that was playing was these Rasta people, like, talking their teacher into smoking pot. And, like, I'm just like, I didn't even smoke pot. Like, why is this, what is this doing here on this tape? And I got to thinking, like, there was another glimpse where there was the end of one song, and then it had clearly been taken off of somebody else's mixtape because there was a Metallica song after that. And I realized that I had taken that song off of a tape that this boy had made for another girl and that she had tossed out and I ended up with. And I was like, oh, wow, Caroline, like you basically made this mixtape spitting his stuff right back at him. You gave him nothing, absolutely nothing of yourself. Like, there wasn't an Indigo Girls song. There was nothing from Rhythm of the Saints. Oh, I used to write Paul Simon love letters weekly back then. You just, you know, took what you thought he wanted and spat it right back to him. And I hope that in 20 years, my 56-year-old self will have as much empathy for me now as I do for me at 16. And I'm seeing I have 20 seconds, and I'm just going to say that if you do want to know the person you're giving a gift to, give them something of yourself. Don't give them a diary.
I feel like I have to make Caroline a mixtape. I won't put any Broken Valley Road show on it. Jeremy Smith. Jeremy was born outside Chicago, educated outside Boston, and lives and works in the shadow of Mount Jumbo. He is a journalist specializing in profiles for Gourmet, Sunset, Montana Magazine, the Chicago Tribune, and Discover, among many other publications. Jeremy is also the author of Growing a Garden City, which you can find at Fact and Fiction Books, as well as the bookstore at the University of Montana. Please join me in welcoming Jeremy Smith.
This is the story of my relationship with the most beautiful woman in the world. And it starts in seventh grade at a sleepover. There were no girls there, just guys. But at midnight, somebody organized us in a circle and said, okay, you're going to step forward one at a time, and you're going to say who you like. High pressure. But I knew who I liked. I'd actually liked the same girl for 3 years. I knew the exact date because I'd gotten a diary in fourth grade. And the first page, first entry I'd written, Anne Crosby. Oh, just marry the girl. And when I saw her in the hall, my legs would shake and my chest would burn and I would blink uncontrollably. And I would just try to talk to her for a few seconds and then I'd have to abort. But this was my chance. Put it out there for the world. See what happened. I get in the circle. I'm ready to step forward. And the guy goes, oh, just one more thing. No one can say Anne Crosby. Because, duh, that's obvious. And that duh was devastating to me, okay? Because I knew how special Anne was. And I knew how incredible she made me feel. But I had no idea that other people knew that too, that they felt the same way, that the entire school liked Anne Crosby. I didn't have a chance. I turned away from the circle, and I didn't even think about talking to her for 5 more years. If Anne Crosby was cute in fourth grade, if she was prettiest girl in school in seventh grade. By 12th grade, she was one of the most beautiful women in the country. And I can say this objectively because when we had our yearbook photos taken, they got sent to this company in Texas that like processes every yearbook photo in the entire nation. And this company literally sees a photograph of every single high school student. In the United States of America, they choose one for their poster for ordering yearbook photos that goes in the hall of every high school in America, double life size, and Crosby. So whatever small chance I had when she was a local phenomenon was gone. Went to college. 4 years passed. Graduated. Went home. Get invited to a party, not unlike the sleepover. Except this time, there are girls there. People I haven't seen in 4 years, people haven't seen me. I walk in the door, push through, apartment in Chicago. First person I see, other end of the apartment, behind the kitchen counter, Ann Crosby. I know what you're asking. Was she still beautiful? Well, is the sun still hot, people? Ann Crosby was now like a CIA secret experiment, okay? She was beautiful on like a need-to-know basis. You literally could not conceive of her in her entirety. You could only focus on one part of her at a time, and you still had to like narrow your eyes and just kind of, you know, from the glare. But hey, I changed too, okay? I was super skinny. High school, I put on a little bit. You know, I was short. I got a little taller. I had glasses. Now they were contacts. Not only in high school had I not kissed Ann Crosby, I hadn't kissed anyone. And in this interim time, I had kissed someone. Maybe gone a few steps past that. And with that, I had the courage to step forward until I'm 6 inches away from the sun. And I said, Ann, how are you? She could have ignored me. It would have been an honor. Okay? She could have said, fine, like a normal person and turned around. She did something crazy, though. She answered the question seriously. And her lips are moving. That's the part I just decided to focus on. And I'm like narrowing my eyes and they're talking to me. And this is what she says. She says, you know, in high school, I love that we went to a diverse high school. This is Ann talking. And I wanted that experience in college, so I went to Atlanta. And there was a lot of diversity there, but it was also really segregated where I went. That's what it turned out to be. And so if I tried to sit with someone who didn't look exactly like me, I got a lot of static from them, and I got a lot of static from the people who did look like me. And I was really lonely and alone. And I hear this, and I'm thinking, Ann Crosby is telling me she's lonely. Step forward, kiss her. But my legs shake, and before I can dare, she goes on. And she says, yeah, I transferred to a small college in Ohio. It wasn't a super diverse place, but my best friend Molly was there, and I just wanted a friend then. And I found that, and it was great for a little bit. Molly was on the soccer team, though. They traveled. One day, there was a bus crash, and Molly died. My eyes widen. I force them up from her lips to her eyes. And I say, oh my God, you know, I'm so sorry. And my arms kind of open and I'm thinking, like, you could get to hug Ann Crosby. But my chest is burning. I can't do it. And she goes on again. She's like, yeah, I mean, after that, you know, her friends from the soccer team were the people who knew her best besides me. And we just hung out and we just cried together. And, you know, they were the only ones who understood what I was going through. And I, you know, even after the immediate shock of what had happened, this is Ann still talking, she said, you know, those became my new friends. And I actually even started traveling with them to their games. And I would cheer them on from the sidelines and try to give them little tips if I could. And they seemed to appreciate it. And I realized, hey, I'm in a small town in Ohio, not a super diverse place, but what diversity there is actually on this athletic team. And on athletic teams in general, you find that people don't care what you look like or where you're from. They care, you know, who you are and what you do. And that meant a lot to me, and said, you know, especially after losing Molly. And I realized a minute had passed, and I had not thought for that whole minute about what she looked like. I had actually been only focusing on the words she was saying, and that was strange. And I wanted to know what happened next, and I just said that. I said, what are you going to do now? And she said, yeah, I've been thinking about that, and I guess I'm going to go back to college and try to coach. You know, try to pass on what I learned to other people just about who you are is what matters and being the best person you can be every day. And my eyes were kind of blinking, but again, it wasn't because of what she looked like. It was because I was actually moved by her story. And I kind of opened my arms again at it, but I didn't touch her. I just put them together and I just said, you know, good for you. That's great. And we talked for like a minute more. I turned around. I went home eventually. And I got up the next day. And the crazy thing was I wasn't mad at myself for not having tried to kiss Ann Crosby. It was actually the first day in 12 years that I didn't want to kiss Ann Crosby. And it wasn't because she wasn't beautiful. She was like intergalactically beautiful. But her story was even more beautiful to me. And I realized at the end of her story, she had figured out what she wanted to be, a coach. And I figured out what I wanted to be, a writer. I wanted to hear people's stories about their life-changing moments or where they changed other people's lives. And I wanted to share them with other people. And that's what I've tried to do as a journalist and a writer since then. So it's been 10 years. And I haven't seen or spoken to Ann Crosby since that party. But tonight, for the first time in a long time, I think I'm going to remember her in my diary. Thank you.
Jeremy Smith, everybody. That concludes tonight's Tell Us Something. I want to encourage everyone to thank the storytellers. We had a lot of guts up here tonight. It's not an easy thing to get up here and tell stories, and it's especially not an easy thing to get up and tell some of the kinds of stories that were told tonight. So thank you to all the storytellers. You're amazing, and I love all of you. A quick list of thank yous. Also, Tell Us Something is brought to you by the bookstore at the University of Montana and the Missoula Art Museum. Tell Us Something would like to thank the bookstore at the University of Montana, a local bookstore serving students, staff, and faculty of the university, as well as the general community. Thanks to Deborah Magpie Erling, the artist who gave us the Lost Journals of Sacagawea, and the wonderful story herself this evening. Already thanked the Missoula Art Museum, Fact and Fiction, Garage Cheese, who screen printed that poster. There are more, I think, left. Yeah? Anybody who wants a poster, grab one on your way out. Once they're gone, that's it. So get one if you want one. Special thanks to Nick Shans for technical support earlier this month, and Jess Millett for helping with timekeeping tonight. The next Tell Us Something event is scheduled for March 6th and will be at the Top Hat. details forthcoming. Thank you all for joining us. Celebrate the art and craft of storytelling here in Missoula.
Thank you for your support of live storytelling and local art. Tell Us Something would like to thank the bookstore at the University of Montana, a local bookstore serving the Missoula community and the students, faculty, and staff of the University of Montana. More at montanabookstore.com. Fact and Fiction, where books, authors, ideas, and readers interact. More at factandfictionbooks.com. Missoula Art Museum, free expression, free admission. More at missoulaartmuseum.org. Deborah Magpie Earling for sharing her story and for the inspiration for this quarter's theme with her exhibit, The Lost Journals of Sacagawea, with photo interventions by Peter Rutledge Koch. Josh Quick, illustration and design. Josh Quick, who designed the posters for this event. More at quickjosh.com. Garage Tees, screen printing, t-shirts, and more. Montana is for badasses. More at garagetees.net. Rockin' Rudy's for providing the timekeeping gong. Great music, great people. Your home for music, gifts, and more. Rockin'Rudy's.com. Jess Millett for her help with timekeeping during the event. Nick Shantz for his help restoring the site when the servers crashed. The next Tell Us Something podcast will be posted shortly after the next event. Like us on Facebook, find us on Twitter, or at tellussomething.org. The next Tell Us Something event is scheduled for March 7th at the Top Hat, and the theme is Rites of Passage. Everyone has a story. What's yours?